Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we travel to Homer, where they recently reenacted one of the town's most memorable moments. We chat with the creator of the Lucky Cow comic strip, a strip set in a fast food restaurant, talk with the sculptor who's turning a huge slab of limestone into a statue in front of the Urbana Free Library, and talk to a photographer who has just published a book featuring two of his favorite things, hot rods and pinups. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. The small Champaign County town of Homer doesn't make news very often, but it happened in a very unusual way in 1949. AM580's Tom Rogers visited Homer as it celebrated a milestone and staged a recreation of one of the town's oddest, yet well-known, moments.
Historical event number one in Homer was the whole reason the town celebrated its sesquicentennial this year. In 1855, the town's 200 or so residents packed up and moved south a couple miles, from the banks of the Salt Fork to where the railroad was crossing the prairie of eastern Champaign County. During Homer's 150-year celebration last month, the townspeople decided to restage historical event number two. The star performer was a 7-year-old Holstein cow named Chesapeake. The stage was the front aisle of the old Homer Hardware Store, right among the garden tools and Crosley appliances. The original venue, Penny's Rexall Drugstore, is long gone. Homer Historical Society President Ray Cunningham takes it from there.
During the summer of 1949, there was a business downturn on Main Street. And that was because of the polio epidemic. Several children had contracted polio in Homer, and the merchants were beginning to feel a decline in revenue. So Ed Kenny, owner of Kenny's Drugstore, had been talking with Herb Clem, a local farmer, and they had talked about that a cow would probably do better in air conditioning, which Ed Kenny had at his store, in his soda shop at the time. And so they devised bringing a cow in and milking it. The event was picked up by the Associated Press and was run nationwide at the time and caught everyone's attention.
The stunt appeared on postcards and the Rexall drug chain's national calendar. Kenny liked publicity. Cunningham says the drugstore owner would drum up business during his crazy days promotion by dressing up in oddball clothing and walking the streets hawking that week's sale items.
I mean, the cow's real gentle, but a lot of people and everything, so if we could just kind of clear everybody out of this area.
Cut to 2005. Three of farmer Herb Clem's sons and several grandchildren and great-grandchildren assemble with several dozen other people inside the stuffy hardware store, which, unlike Kenny's drugstore, has no air conditioning.
That's what Dad wanted, an air conditioning place to help you out.
Yeah.
As two of the Clem sons sit on lawn chairs and reminisce, in comes Chesapeake.
She's bigger than old Beth.
This is Melvin. Melvin is the oldest grandson of Herb, and actually Melvin was in the picture also. And I did want to mention that the two culprits that brought the cow into town in the wagon is right here, Don Clem and Ken Clem, are the two that brought the cow back into town in the wagon so the grandpa could milk it. So the only question we have today is 2% or whole or any worse bucket.
Right here. Yeah.
Here we go. Don't see if she'll give any milk. I didn't trust to pump the tail.
Melvin admits that farming is not his career. He's a retired operating engineer.
I used to milk a little bit, but it's only been 50 years ago, so I lost.
Don't spray anybody.
I remember the street was full of people. Well, they said, what, there's 1,100 people here? That was the main attraction Homer for Friday night. Town was full and the store was full. It was a big deal.
Especially for a 10-year-old kid like Melvin. 56 years later, Chesapeake the cow probably could have used the air conditioning inside the hardware store. The milk wasn't flowing, and what she did give often found its way onto the floor.
No, it's not doing it anymore. I think he's
Robot.
But it was a welcome sideshow for a weekend that featured historical presentations, food and craft sales, music at Homer Park, and all the other small-town festival staples. Low output aside, the cow was a hit. And 56 years after his publicity stunt, Ed Kenny's ideas kept paying off.
Bring her up. Come on, Chesapeake. You were a good girl.
For Sidetrack, I'm Tom Rogers.
From one cow story to another. Sort of. Lucky Cow is a daily comic strip about a fictitious fast food chain and the particular goings-on at one franchise. The creator of the strip is Mark Pett. He has just released the first collection of Lucky Cow strips. It's out by Andrews McMeel Publishing. I talked with Pett recently about what goes into a strip about fast food and about the world's largest comic strip, a project he was involved in. First, I asked, what inspired him to do a strip about a fast food chain?
Well, I guess I grew up with a kind of love-hate relationship with fast food. I remember when I was a little kid, I won an art contest, and the prize that I got was a $2 bill that was encased in plastic. And, it was like a mint condition $2 bill, and that was my prize. And I broke it open and spent the $2 on a Big Mac. So that kind of was a precursor of things to come. You know, I guess fast food is so American. Yeah, I mean, when you think about when you travel abroad or something and you see fast food restaurants there, they just seem so quintessentially American, you know, and all types of people go to fast food restaurants. It's a place that's really, truly diverse, and so for me, that was a really attractive aspect of it.
So how does all that translate into this comic strip you do now called Lucky Cow?
Well, one thing I love to do is to really, to me, one of the main characters is Lucky Cow, the fast food chain. And so at the start of every Sunday, I do a title panel. It's always an advertisement for Lucky Cow, the fast food chain. And those are fun for me to do because I get to kind of satirize in a way, you know, the way fast food restaurants, to me, kind of seem to approach the world. And so for me, that's kind of a fun way to kind of poke fun at fast food and then ourselves, too. It's, to me, I guess I see the strip as an invitation to people to laugh at themselves and their own kind of love-hate relationship with fast food. I think we all probably have it.
You know, just about everyone in this country has probably had fast food more than on one occasion.
Yeah.
So we all know what it's like, and probably a good number of people have worked their first jobs as a fast food person.
In fact, I read somewhere that something like 1 in 8 people will at some time work in a McDonald's at some point in their lives, and I think that's a rather remarkable statistic.
Have you ever worked at a fast food place?
Well, actually, when I decided I was going to set my comic strip in a fast food restaurant, I had not worked. I had worked in restaurants, mm-hmm. but not in a fast food restaurant.
Not a major chain.
Right. And so I decided I needed to see firsthand what it was like. And so I actually took a job working full time at a major fast food chain that begins with the letter M. And just so I could kind of, at least for a little while, experience what it was like behind the counter and try out the different jobs and things like that. And I recognize it was not quite the same because I wasn't, you know, supporting myself with my minimum wage income and everything. But at least I feel like I got to, you know, see firsthand what it was like. And I talked to people and interviewed them and things like that.
Now, are some of your characters from the comic strip sort of based on amalgams of people you've met?
Yeah, in fact, that's what I would say. I would say they're all kind of amalgams of sorts. But occasionally, like, I actually took strip ideas from people I'd met in the working in fast food. For instance, there was one woman, a young woman, and every day, you know, we had these name tags, and every day she had a different name tag. You know, she had a different name on her name tag. You know, one day it was, you know, Lakeisha, and the next day it was, you know, Betty, and then, you know, and so on. Every day was something different. And I asked her, you know, why do you keep having a different name tag? And she said, well, it's in case anybody calls to complain about me. So I actually turned that into a comic strip. I thought that was pretty funny.
Well, that was a trick used by one of your characters in the comic strip, Claire, who's one of my favorites. Her and Neil are two of my absolute favorites. In the comic strip, and I guess for people who might not realize who these characters are, why don't you give us sort of a thumbnail personality sketch of these two very opposite, very different sort of characters?
Yeah, well, Claire is, she's the daughter of the manager of this particular franchise of Lucky Cow, and she doesn't want to work there. She doesn't want to work, period, really, and she's always looking for ways to get out of working. She's always trying to quit, but her father won't let her. And he is something of an enabler because he doesn't actually crack down too hard. He's a kind of easygoing, and he really loves the world of fast food, and he really wants his daughter to like it too. Neil, on the other hand, is happy to work. You know, he really enjoys working there, but he's kind of slow-witted, but a sweet guy, and he's always ends up kind of doing the right thing. Sometimes he's had some moral quandaries about things, and he really debates them, but he ends up doing the right thing, and he gets confused a lot about things. And he's sort of Claire's Claire's dupe a lot of the time. She makes him do things that she wouldn't want to do.
So has working on a comic strip about fast food changed the way that you eat? Do you actually still go out for fast food? Do you still go through the drive-thrus?
Well, I wondered if working behind the counter I would feel less inclined to go to a place like McDonald's. But actually, I have to say, I was actually rather impressed with how sanitary it seemed back there. I was sort of waiting. I was, in fact, kind of hoping to, you know, see some little, to have some little horror stories to tell afterward. But, you know, on the whole, it was not bad. You know, occasionally somebody would drop something on the floor and then still put it back in the, you know, in the bin or whatever. But that was rare.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go to eat fast food as much anymore, and it's probably because I'm thinking about it all the time. But I do go occasionally for inspiration, and we'll sit and work in a restaurant sometime.
Now, because you do this comic strip, Lucky Cow, about fast food,
uh-huh.
Has anybody approached you about actually opening up like a Lucky Cow restaurant?
Actually, yeah, early on, there was a woman who wanted to open up a chain right when the Strip first started. And we talked about it, whether that would be possible, but I think it would be a real challenge because it would have to be a restaurateur that was willing to cope with a lot of irony. I mean, you would have to be able to, you know, run the fast food restaurant like, you know, like the one in the comic strip, you know, like the...
have the bad puns about the actual names of the foods.
Right, do that kind of thing and to really embrace all of these, you know, audacious qualities that, you know, that fast food restaurants often have. You know, I guess because in the advertisements that I make for the Lucky Cow restaurants, there a lot of times they really make you cringe, or at least they make me cringe, and I know they make other people cringe. And so it would be somebody who would be really willing to embrace that, and I think I don't think it would probably sell too many burgers either, so I don't know. I don't know that it's possible, but and especially not early on in the comic strip.
Right, but so. I guess you're still open for offers.
Well, you know, I'm willing to consider them, but that one ultimately didn't work out, but it was kind of fun that somebody actually wanted to do it.
So, tell us about the world's largest comic strip.
Well, yeah, this was a couple of years ago. It was right when the strip was just getting started, and I worked with a local art teacher. I live in the Mississippi Delta right now, and there was a local art teacher at a high school who wanted to work with her students. They were working on taking small, you know, pieces of art and enlarging them, how to enlarge things, using usually like a kind of gridding method. And she wanted to work with me on creating the world's largest comic strip out of one of the Lucky Cow comic strips. And so we did. This was actually a semester project, but and 150 students. We used something like 1,500 sheets of poster board, you know, that like elementary school kids use for their science projects and stuff like that, that kind of poster board. And we laid them all together, and the students hand-painted them. And we created a comic strip that was something like 45 feet high and 135 feet long, something like that. In fact, there are pictures available on my website, which is www.markpett.com. And it was, in fact, certified by Guinness as the world's largest comic strip. And it was something of a challenge to photograph it because we live in a very flat part of the country where there are no hills or no tall buildings because it's quite rural. And I had to enlist the help of a lot of local people trying to get pictures of this thing. So we got a local utility worker came down and helped us, you know, let us ride up in the cherry picker to take pictures. But that wasn't quite high enough, so we ended up getting a local balloonist to take us up in his hot air balloon to take pictures of it. It was really quite amazing.
Oh, I bet.
And it was remarkably accurate. And faithful to the original, so.
And hopefully funny as well.
the kids thought so. They picked the one they wanted to use, so I don't know if it was worthy of being so large, but it ended up being 67,000 times the size of the typical size of a comic strip.
Wow.
So yeah, it was neat.
So what is the future of Lucky Cow?
The future?
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to see, I guess. We're going to carry on. I'm enjoying just seeing what happens. Like, Claire and Neil have really sort of taken over as the focus of the strip, which just kind of happened. I didn't plan on it that way. We'll see. I'm enjoying just kind of taking it week by week and seeing where the characters take it.
That was Mark Pett, creator of the Lucky Cow comic strip. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Some natural areas need fire. A number of prairie plants and pine trees must have fire for their seeds to pop open or germinate. But burning a natural area can quickly turn into a wildfire without a team to keep it under control. The Great Lakes Radio Consortium's Mark Brush spent a day with a burn crew and brings us this audio postcard.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. How's it going?
Good.
Hey.
A little dry?
It's pretty dry. It's forecasted, I think, to be like 21% humidity.
Okay.
My name is David Mindell, and I am the burn boss for this project. I'm a contractor that does ecological restoration. The first step is we'll just take a quick walk through and rake some of the fuel around stuff we don't want to burn.
You know, this is the kind of thing that if fire got in here, it would burn for hours and hours and just put out a lot of smoke.
My name's Lee Root, and I just am a burn crew member.
I'm filling up what's known as an Indian tank. It's a backpack frame that has a water tank and a hand pump. This is our little portable fire engine.
So you can see where the blacktop is. If that was our fire and we didn't want the fire to come onto the grass, we would just spray like that, and that would prevent the fire from crossing over.
Well, my name's Ross Orr, and I've been working with David for a couple of years, and we're wearing these crazy screaming yellow bodysuits that are flame retardant fabric, and it also just helps keep us cool from the radiant heat of the burn. Big cumbersome helmets with visors that flip up and down. We'll ignite using drip torches, which are these canisters filled with a mixture of diesel and gas. It's got a wick on the end, a burning wick, and as you tip the canister, it dribbles the gas diesel mix across the wick and trails fire as you go.
Yellow, lots of fire.
Okay, I'm gonna burn it up right next to you, Lee.
Go ahead.
All right, here we go.
David, Catherine and I are up at the end. It's a similar thing, Lee. Once you walk down the ridge top and Catherine can follow you, walking on the east edge.
Alright. Catherine, keep coming right around.
Is this one of the crab apples you wanted to save, or they're on the other end?
I believe they're on the other end, unless there are crab apples there.
Nope.
Don't worry about it.
It's a hawthorn, not even a crab apple.
My name's Catherine Marquardt. And I do whatever they tell me to do, whether it's lighting fires or putting them out. I think it kind of looks like a Dr. Seuss story, actually, sometimes when you burn it and it's all black. You don't get to see this very often. It's very cool. And then it greens up so quickly. That's the other amazing thing, is that if you come back here in a couple days, it's already getting green, so it changes so quickly.
You know, I'm guessing it took probably 45 minutes for the back burn to go a third of the way through the unit, and I think a head burn will run through the other two-thirds in about 3 minutes. Basically just walking around looking for things that are still smoking. Got a juniper that's smoking at the base. And just spraying out the smoldering bits. Burning is extremely fun, but it's also it's a great management tool for improving the ecological quality in natural areas.
That audio postcard of a prairie burn was produced by the GLRC's Mark Brush. You're listening to Sidetrack. Currently outside the Urbana Free Library, Indiana resident and University of Illinois graduate Todd Fromm is using power tools, hammers, and chisels to transform a 20-ton block of limestone into a statue based on Aesop's fable of the tortoise and the hare. I recently went out there to visit him and find out more about what he's doing.
Usually, people do this in a studio. You know, what caused you to come out here and do it under the hot summer sun?
Well, it's the trade. You know, the library wanted that for the public, and this piece, it's not really an indoor piece. You know, you have to. I would have to find a place to carve something like this anyway, so it works out for everybody.
It's a very dusty and dirty business, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sort of walk us through what the material is and how you go about carving the image that you're going to be using, or the final image.
Well, it's limestone, and I'm using anything that works, really. I'm using diamond abrasives, diamond discs, grinding discs, air chisels, air pneumatic hammers, and shims and wedges, really old-fashioned tools. They're basically, you drill a hole, you put a shim and a wedge in there, and you split the stone apart. So I'm taking the big pieces off with that.
So how did you get started sculpting in stone like this?
I actually took an interest in it in high school a little bit, not stone carving, but then I went to Parkland College, where Chris Birdie teaches stone sculpture, stone carving, and that's where I got my start carving stone. And then I took classes. I did my undergrad at the U of I with Roger Blakely and Peter Fagan, and continued to carve stone there as well, which is how I met Robin Hall, the retired director of the Urbana Park District, and I got my first commission that way, and one led to the next, which led to this. So,
is this the biggest piece you've done, or are you about?
So far, this is the biggest piece, yeah.
And how long do you think it's going to take you to actually complete the whole thing?
Somewhere around, they'd like to have it the end of July. That might be pushing it a little. I'm going to try and get it done by then, but probably the first week in August sometime.
Why stone? Why limestone? Is this your material of choice? Is this the one you like the most?
Not necessarily. I work in everything. I work in bronze and tire tread and you name it. Yeah, it's just something I started with, something that not too many people do on the large scale anymore. It's hard, you know, it's a lot of work, and there's a lot involved in getting 40,000 pounds of stone moved from one place to another. And most people don't do it unless there's a commission involved, and I wouldn't do this unless there was a commission involved, because, you know, once you move it someplace, you don't want to move it again.
It's pretty heavy.
Yeah. I just wanted it to be site-specific and appropriate for all ages, people that will be coming by. So, you know, I tried to think of something that was universally appealing, and Aesop's Fables and The Tortoise and the Hare seems to have, you know, recognition at any age level. And it's something, you know, that... kids will respond to, be able to climb on a little bit, hopefully not all the way up to the top.
That's sculptor Todd Fromm. He can currently be seen chipping away at a large block of limestone in front of the Urbana Free Library. Still to come on the program, we hear a commentary from engineer Bill Hammack, and we talk hot rods and pinups with photographer David Perry. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. Engineer Bill Hammack spent some time on this recent 4th of July doing something we all might want to consider.
Every 4th of July I read the Declaration of Independence. I do this partly because I enjoy its eloquent phrases, partly because its lofty sentiments fill me with historical pride, but mostly I reread it to be a better citizen. It is, after all, the founding document. Over the years, I've detected, with my engineer's eye, an unmistakable trace of science and math in the Declaration. It reads like a geometric proof with its laws of nature and its truths held to be self-evident like axioms. It first lays down axioms like all men are created equal, and then derives, if you will, an indictment against King George III. I've learned that there is more than an echo of scientific reasoning in the Declaration. Phrases like laws of nature had deeper meaning for the founders. Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Benjamin Franklin, all members of the committee that wrote the Declaration, used science as a source for metaphors. They believed it to be the supreme expression of human reason. For no founder was science more important than Jefferson, the Declaration's main author. In a letter, he revealed, "Nature intended me for the tranquil pursuits of science by rendering them my supreme delight." He filled his writings with discussions of plows, air pumps, compasses, canal locks, balloons, and steam power. He stocked his library at Monticello with books on every aspect of science and technology, none more important to him than Euclid's geometry and Isaac Newton's great works on physics. At Monticello, Jefferson had a picture gallery of intellectual giants. He assigned a high place to three portraits, one of which was Isaac Newton. He esteemed Newton as one of the greatest minds the world had produced. Jefferson had both the Latin original and English translations of Newton's Principia in his library. He is surely our only president who's actually read it. So, when Jefferson opened the Declaration of Independence by asking the American people to assume the powers of the earth to which the laws of nature entitled them, he meant more than natural law, the supreme moral law known to humankind through reason. To Jefferson and the other founders, the words laws of nature had a deeper resonance. They evoked a picture of Newton's laws of motion, of the universe as one great harmonious order obeying mathematical laws, a world in which it was natural that humans have inalienable rights. How does all this help me today to be a better citizen? Well, in hindsight, the founders too glibly made a leap from the laws of gravity to the laws of human interaction. In reading the Declaration, one can easily forget that the dignity and the rights of man are neither a self-evident axiom nor an inalienable right, but instead a hard-earned acquisition that we must continually work to keep.
Bill Hammack teaches chemical engineering at the University of Illinois. His essays on engineering and life can be found on the web at engineerguy.com. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. In 1996, two friends began traveling to different places in the world to make balloon hats for people and take photos of them. Their goal was to show people all over the world laughing and having fun, and to emphasize the fact that all human beings are born with the ability to experience joy. To date, they have visited 34 states and 34 countries and have taken over 10,000 pictures. Scott Gurian has this profile.
Adi Somek seems like an everyday, down-to-earth sort of guy, but he spent the past 12 years of his life making balloon hats for people.
I started twisting balloons just to make money, like I needed a job. And I thought, okay, this is cool, but it's also kind of lame at the same time. I thought that I was like a novelty act, and I thought that this was a substitute for my real dream, which was to play music.
He originally thought his part-time hobby might last a few months, but then he went back to school.
And I'd have homework, and I would just procrastinate by twisting balloons. And eventually, I had to admit to myself, like, I'm actually good at this.
Adi's balloon hats are quite elaborate and unique creations. Some people have even described them as natural extensions of their bodies. Over time, Adi slowly recognized that his hats were actually quite meaningful to people.
At that point, I was making $150 an hour, twisting balloons at corporate parties. And I was volunteering at homeless shelters for, like, abused wives and kids. At that point is when I realized that the super rich and the super poor were laughing at the same thing in the same way. That's when I began to have more respect for balloon twisting.
It was around this time that Adi met Charlie, an amateur photographer whose day job was redesigning people's closets.
And what happened was, he came over to my house once and there was a Halloween party. But to get into the party, you needed costumes and we didn't have any. So I said, I make balloon hats.
So he made these hats for us. He whipped them out in a couple minutes.
That's Charlie Eckert.
We walked out of his apartment and instantly somebody came up to us. She was just ecstatic and thanking us profoundly for making her a night. And then on the subway, like, people were coming from other cars. And I grew up here and I've never seen anything like this.
He had never seen people like go out of their way to express like that level of positivity before. And he thought, man, these balloons are kind of like, if they affect people in New York, I wonder what it would be like if you took them other places.
The more they thought about it, the more exciting this idea seemed. So Adi and Charlie saved up some money and embarked upon 7 trips across the country and around the world. While Adi made hats for people, Charlie took thousands of pictures to document their journeys. Sitting in a friend's apartment, Adi flips through a calendar he's made using some of the photos. In one memorable photograph, a flower vendor in Russia's St. Petersburg Square nonchalantly grasps a display of carnations and poses for the camera. He's wearing a hat that strikingly resembles the cathedral domes behind him. In another photograph, an African man and his wife stand on a dusty Kenyan road, proudly and earnestly sporting their newly acquired crowns.
The headdress for them was a really important cultural symbol. So when we showed up to a town and we just busted out the balloons and started making balloon hats, we were taken right away to the chief. And we'd have to make the chief a balloon hat, and then his wives, and then his children, and then the regular people. It wasn't just like a fun novelty. It was like a serious sign of respect, which really kind of blew me away. I didn't really ever think about it like that.
The more places Adi and Charlie traveled, the more they realized that balloons had an amazing ability to connect with people in ways that crossed all cultural and language barriers.
We were in Vietnam, up in the mountains where the Hmong people are, in this town called Sapa. And this anthropologist saw what we were doing, and he said, you know, you guys have gotten more into this culture in one afternoon than I have in 6 months, just because you made people laugh.
After hearing all these stories, I was curious to see for myself how people would react to the balloon hats. So Adi and I went walking around Washington, D.C.'s Georgetown neighborhood.
Do you like a balloon hat?
Not really.
Do you want a balloon hat?
A what?
A balloon hat. I'm a balloon hat maker, and I just make them for free.
No, that's okay.
Okay.
For some reason, we just didn't seem to have much luck, but Adi understood the problem.
Most people, when they make a balloon hat, it's not really like a well-crafted thing. They're just, it's like a bowl of spaghetti dumped on someone's head, you know? For me, as a balloon hat maker, part of the whole pitch is to somehow let people know that I'm not trying to goof on them. They're not going to be seen as foolish.
We figured that if we could just convince one person to wear a hat, the momentum would suddenly change and soon everyone would want one. We decided to try our luck in a very different neighborhood, inner city southeast D.C. As we approached a group of people wearing jeans and waiting at a bus stop, they looked at us strangely, aware that we were not from their neighborhood. But after we described what we were doing, it wasn't long before we attracted quite a crowd.
Watch this right here. This is what they got. Look at it.
Yeah, like that, yeah.
Oh, man.
He bad. He bad. He bad.
That is something.
I want me a hat. That one's called the High-Low Rider. It's made with the Instant Classic head base. It's got some black, a curly on top, some ballies, and a dinghy in orange.
Thank you. I am so impressed.
You get a real high when you make people happy. You know, because if you make something that makes someone else happy, that happiness bounces off them back to you. And then all of a sudden there's two people that are really happy.
After making balloons in 34 states and 34 countries, Adi says that traveling has taken its toll on him. The rhythm he's developed of meeting people and then leaving a few moments later has affected his non-balloon relationships with women. And he says he's spent so much time around children that he can't imagine ever having kids of his own. He'd like to one day settle down and lead what he calls a normal life, or perhaps host some sort of balloon hat TV show. Before he retires, though, Adi Somek hopes to find some devoted students so he can pass along his balloon-making experience.
That feature was produced by Scott Gurian. This is Sidetrack. It's summertime, and when you're out on the weekends, there's no doubt you'll see someone taking their vintage automobile out cruising. And more than likely, it's a guy behind the wheel. There's just something about a cool car that speaks to the soul of most red-blooded American males. There's just something magical about an old hot rod. To an earlier generation, nothing looked better next to these old cars than a pinup girl. Hot rod magazines in the 1950s would always make sure to include pretty girls standing next to the automobiles. Well, that tradition is all but gone in today's car magazines, but one photographer, David Perry, is trying to revisit that era in his new book titled Hot Rod Pinups. It's published by Motor Books. Besides the photos, Perry and guest writers explore the intersection between hot rods and pinups and how both fit into modern popular culture. I recently spoke with Perry and asked him first to explain the connection between hot rods and pinups and why they seem to go together.
Ooh, I think it has to do with some aspect of what I call street theater. It's just a very flashy subject matter. I think being involved in the scene, there's always women around. Part of the reason why guys build hot rods is to get the girl. I also wanted to bring in this sort of mythological aspect to the work, so I think it's more of what it represents than a literal portrayal of people and their cars or with cars.
Is the lure of the hot rod, is it just to get the girl, or is there more to it? Is it more about the object itself and maybe the time period it represents?
Well, I think the hot rod probably represents different things to different people. You ask builders why they build it, and they want a cool ride. They want something that will get attention. They want something that makes them feel special. It's an individual statement of their personality. I don't think anyone will actually say they build it to get girls, if that answers your question.
But, you know, it doesn't hurt. So explain, I guess, who the typical hot rodder is in a more specific way and the objects they work on, you know, what types of cars are they working on, and where do they show them off at?
Well, the hot rodders I know, it varies. I mean, there's the older generation that has a racing background and the Bonneville Salt Flats for land speed racing and drag racing events and shows. And I think the older hot rodder has more of a mechanical background and was interested in it from that standpoint and from a speed standpoint. I think there was also a visual aspect of it, but it more came out of racing, really. The hot rod is a stripped-down vehicle with nothing on it that isn't absolutely necessary. The younger generation, I think, got more caught up in the lifestyle and the look of it and learned the skills in order to build them. A lot of the younger hot rodders are artists and musicians, tattooists, filmmakers, set builders, painters. I think they look at it and approach it much more from the aesthetic standpoint than maybe the older generation. Not to say that the older generation didn't make great cars, because they did, and the younger generation looks at what they build and kind of amps it up a bit. I think the music mixes in pretty well with the newer scene, psychobilly, rockabilly, punk. So the cars have that danger feel, a lot of them, or they're just very stylized. If it's a sled or a custom car, it's very refined. But there is the generational connection also. I think the younger generation respects the older generation to a point. And I think the older generation kind of feels like some of the younger generation stealing their thunder. The newer hot rodders sort of were not that impressed or interested in the older hot rodders' shows, so they came up with their own. Bulletproof is one example that happens in the Bay Area. And so you'll see a crossover, but I think the younger generation really just made its own scene from what they needed, and they brought into it music, tattooing, art, and I think in a way it keeps it alive.
Well, you said something earlier that is really interesting. You were talking about how this culture sort of embraces this idea of danger, and when you look at the cars themselves, they look physically dangerous because some of them are, you know, half there. They're not completed. There's jagged edges. In fact, in one of the notes to one of the photographs, you said something about warning a model about getting too close, ask if she had her tetanus shots, because these things, you know, are rusty and dirty and dingy. Does that sort of add to the whole thing, the whole package?
I think it does. I think it gives it an edge, and it confuses people. Well, when are you going to paint it? You know, and they'll say it is painted, or where's the floorboard? You know, I don't need them. And I think it gets pretty extreme as far as statements. I've seen cars chopped so low that they're cartoons and they're not even really drivable. And that's kind of also a part of the hot rodding lore. Big Daddy Roth built cars with bubble tops and one stick for driving, for gas, for everything, so it reaches a point where sometimes it's just one-upmanship. But on the most part, the hot rods in the book are all drivable and, you know, legal, I suppose. Barely legal, but they are legal. And a lot of them, they're works in progress, so they might one day have paint on them. But painting a car, you know, in order to do it right, it takes a lot of time in body work and a lot of expense in paint, and a lot of guys just want to drive it now, and they're not all that worried about the paint. Robert Williams, famous hot rod painter and artist, he says he's the first one to actually do a car in primer and leave it that way and say it's done. because that's really how you saw the cars, I think, back in the day, is a lot of them were works in progress, and you saw them in primer. And there's something about flat black or flat paint that gives it a little more of a menacing look than shiny cars. When you see a car which is shiny, you realize how much work went into that car. And especially nowadays, you find an old car, you have to do a lot of body work on it before it can get into that shape, whereas back in the 50s or whenever, the cars were not that old, and a lot of them weren't in that bad of shape, so you just put paint over what was already there. And now it's much more work involved. And you can't really paint in your backyard like in the old days, so I think that adds into why the look is how it is. I think a lot of guys just like that ratty look. I think it just it adds into their whole look and danger aspect of it, I believe.
Well, you really capture that in the photographs in the book. In fact, again, in your introductory notes, you were talking about how you didn't want these garages and places where you did the photography at to be cleaned up at all. In fact, if there were beer cans and cigarette butts and grease all over the floor, more the better. And
right.
It's a really interesting juxtaposition between the cars and their dirty and griminess, which, you know, are really brought out, and then the pinup girls, which are very stylized. Tell me about that juxtaposition and that the sort of formula that you use throughout the book.
Well, I think you pretty much described it. Referring back to garages and shops. I'd seen a lot of pictures in car magazines or whatever that were done in studios, and they recreated a garage scene, and it just looked fake and phony. And I really wanted a real environment where the viewer could step in and see, you know, the wrenches on the floor and the spray paint on the shelf and the beer cans around. And I think it added more interest in the pictures, leaving it as they were. Plus, a lot of these shops are museums on their own right. People who own shops have placed signs on the wall and stickers and junk in a way that it inspires them. So I really wanted to show the environment where a lot of these are made. It's the studios, really, of the artist making them. As far as the women are concerned, you want them as polished and shiny as possible. I mean, I think what I had said earlier about a mythological aspect of it, I wanted this kind of idea of perfection as a juxtaposition to a dangerous car or a messy shop. It's kind of the vision maybe the builder has while he's making his car is, you know, he's thinking of this vehicle as being this perfect representation of his art, and the woman sort of exemplifies that, I think, in the pictures. And you don't really want to show women looking, you know, a little ratty. You want them to look good. So we spent a lot of time on makeup and styling and retouching, but I also wanted the people to actually come through the photographs and not just be a prop. I wanted women to actually be involved in the picture. And so I think I achieved that in a few of these.
Well, yeah, it's not like a car show type of thing where you have the beautiful woman pointing to the car and very detached from it. These photos, the women are, you know, very much sort of within the whole aura of the actual vehicle.
Well, that's true. I mean, most of the women in the book, you know, are married or dating hot rodders. They're in that scene. They're around them. They drive them. A few build them. So it's strange that the hot rod magazines and the hot rod world sort of excluded women as a part of it, except, you know, when there's an occasional racer. In the new scene, they're very much a part of it. And so I don't think it seems really odd to have them, you know, by the cars or driving the cars or wrenching on the cars. I mean, that's all real part of it. But also keep in mind that the pictures are a fantasy piece. So it's more of an idealized scene.
Well, this idea of the idealized scene comes through in several of the essays that are also in the book, written by various different people. And in each of these essays, basically the guys writing them, and they're mostly guys, they're remembering back to a certain part in their life and a certain hot rod and maybe even, you know, a certain woman are touchstones for that part of their life, and, you know, they become idealized. Do you see that sort of thread? Was that a conscious thing for all these essays?
Yes, it is. It was. Actually, I had to coax the writers to actually write more about the women because a lot of them just wanted to write about the cars. And I picked people who I thought would understand that aspect of it, the mythological aspect of it, Lady Luck or, you know, the Flat Girl or, you know, the Rosie Riveter. And I think Robert Williams really nails it, Kevin Thompson. I think that they understand it. A lot of them haven't really thought about it that way, and so I think writing about it was new to them. But I think they channeled it pretty well and got it down.
That was photographer David Perry talking about his new book, Hot Rod Pinups. It's published by Motor Books.
The Great Lakes Radio Consortium is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation and the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Cooperative Extension Service. You can learn more about Great Lakes Radio Consortium stories at glrc.org.